to kind of get some context, last week we talked about the end of, I guess you want to call it the first, maybe you could call it the first council, but after Cornelius and Peter went to Cornelius, then Peter was called back to Jerusalem to answer why he was hanging out with all these non-Jews, with the uncircumcised. And he gave his answer there in front of Jerusalem. And then we talked a little bit about the church growing at Antioch. That at Antioch, that was where, we talked about Barnabas, right? Barnabas went to Antioch and eventually got Paul because things were happening there. The word of the Lord was having an effect. And people were getting saved. And so the church there at Antioch was where they were first called Christians. And then we kind of ended the chapter with this prophecy by, I think it's on this chapter here, Agabus, who said there's a famine that is going to occur. And so the church gathered supplies, food, and other things, and sent Paul and Barnabas to Jerusalem to deliver the supplies. So I can kind of point to my little attempt at a timeline here. There's obviously a lot more events happening, but approximately 30 was Pentecost. Approximately 35 was the death of Stephen. I didn't put on here Paul's conversion, but I think we talked about he was 3 years kind of somewhat in isolation. I guess you could call it training. So that would have been approximately 41 based on this timeline here. But it was in early 44 where Agabus gave his prophecy. And that's kind of where we are right now. This event in chapter 12 is slightly outside of the regular narrative that Luke had been given here. He's not necessarily going chronologically, and that's because you have several different leaders that he's following, several different events taking place all over, pretty much all over the world at that time. And so he'll focus on, you know, now he's going back to Peter in this event. He's going to kind of skip back to Paul and Barnabas. So, not necessarily chronological. This is kind of a separate little story here. But then you got August 6, 44. That's the death of Herod. We'll talk about that later. And we'll talk about why we have such a specific date for that. So, early 44 was when Agabus made this prophecy. The church gathered together, supplies sent Paul and Barnabas to Jerusalem. So it's about late 44 that they actually arrived at Jerusalem to deliver the supplies. And then about 5 years after that is the Jerusalem Council. That's when they officially settle the whole issue of Gentiles being saved and whether or not they need to be circumcised when they get saved. So that's kind of where this story fits. We're right in about 44 AD approximately. And so we can begin to talk about, verse 1 says, now about that time, so around the time of this famine and when Paul and Barnabas were sent to Jerusalem, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. So this Herod is actually Herod Agrippa. He was the grandson of Herod the Great. Herod the Great was the one who was alive when Jesus was born and tried to kill Jesus. I believe Herod the Great was the one who finished the temple. When we talk about Herod's temple, I believe it's this, the grandfather here, Herod the Great. I found several, if you're really interested, I can get you a family tree for Herod. There were numerous leaders in this, governors, I guess you would call them, kind of regional leaders over the whole area of Judea and what we would think of as modern day the Middle East there, from Syria and that whole area there. And most of them extended from the family tree of Herod the Great here. This was Herod Agrippa. He ruled over an area that included Syria, Galilee, and Judea. He started in Syria, and as years progressed, his reign expanded. I believe, I can't remember the Roman emperor, It's escaping me when I read about it. But there was Roman emperor that came to the power, I think in the late 30s, early 40s, who was friends with Herod Agrippa, this Herod, and expanded his rule here. But the point is at this time is over all this area, he was the Roman governor, the person that the Roman Empire had put in charge of this area here. So he had, you know, complete control over that area there. I'll mention this in a second, but he did have Jewish blood in him, so he did have ties to the Jewish community there. And that does come into play here. It seems to come out of nowhere, and it does, that he just starts persecuting the church. Well, why did he do that? Well, probably to keep peace with the main Jewish people at the time. Remember, for the most part, the Jewish leaders, the Jewish community, thought of these Christians as revolutionaries, as agitators, as people that were disrupting the normal rule of things. And so Herod, like any good political leader, is going to do what he's good. He feels he has to do to appease the majority of people, to retain power by appeasing the ruling group in that area there. And so, as far as we can tell, for that reason, he starts persecuting the church there. And we'll see that he sees that it works, and so he continues to do it. So verse 2 talks about how he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. And so this James is one of the sons of Zebedee that they talk about throughout, one of the main original 12 disciples here, brother of John, the John the Apostle, that wrote the Gospel of John and, of course, Revelation. Not the James who wrote the Bible here, or the epistle of the Bible. We'll talk about him later, but it's not that James who's the half-brother of Jesus. And it's interesting, we don't get any context whatsoever. Luke just states he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. Most likely he beheaded him. But that's all we get, which is kind of fascinating. We don't get any context. Stephen, the first martyr, the first person who was actually killed for his faith, we get a whole story dedicated to him. But James, we just get, he was killed. And I think that's fascinating. We'll come back to that later. But it's really interesting why Luke doesn't give any more details. But nonetheless, we find out that he was killed by the order of Herod there. And then in the next verse, and this is just, I'm so fascinated by this verse. And when he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. He saw that it worked.
Lizzie Borden, only the male version.
Exactly. So I see this in my kids all the time. They'll do something, whatever it is. You know, my little one, Quinny, is now crawling. My memory for my other kids and the major events in their lives is terrible. But it doesn't seem like they picked up things quite as quickly as Quinny did. Like, last Sunday, I think it was. Literally, in one day, she learned to stand up on the couch. And like, in one try, I'm playing with her in the living room, and she's crawling, and I looked at my phone for a second, and I look over at her, and she's standing on next to the couch. And okay. But now she's crawling. You know, she'll go to something, and she'll kind of look and see your reaction. And if you don't do anything, then she'll continue to do it. And of course, as kids get older, they don't stop doing that. They'll try something, and if they see it works, particularly the two girls I have with me today, Colette and Sonia, they love to pick on each other. And Sonia, or Colette, knows how to pick on, and she'll do whatever it does. She sees that it gets a rise out of Sonia, and so she'll keep doing it. And that's basically what Herod is doing here. He, as far as we can tell from the text, it was somewhat of an arbitrary decision. Maybe because James was a leader of the church, it wasn't totally arbitrary, because why did he go after James and then go after Peter? Well, from what we know in other passages, these had risen prominence in the church. These were regarded as the leaders of the church, particularly Peter. James not quite so much, but still, he was original 12 apostle. He was one of the ones that were very prominent in the church leadership. So the fact that Herod would choose him isn't arbitrary, but the fact that he would choose anybody and execute them does seem arbitrary. But when that works, when it pleases the Jews, they're happy about that. Well, he's going to go, let's go after the main guy at this time, one of the most prominent leaders, which is Peter. Holly?
My study Bible says, too, that Jesus had told both James and his brother John that they would drink the same cup of suffering he did. So right. Isn't that kind of, and that's from Matthew 20? So that would kind of be a prophecy fulfilled, too.
Exactly. And and there's another place where Jesus' words do become prophetic here. What's interesting, though, is, and we'll talk about this in a second, so he promised both James and John that they would get the same cup of suffering. Well, James was in AD 44. John was not for another 50 years. And so, and we'll look at that again. When, you know, Peter is sent to prison, and God gets him out. Paul was sent to prison, was in there much longer. So when you look at, you know, James was killed, Peter was spared, all these different events, what is God's plan in this? And why did he allow James to be killed, but Peter he rescues from prison? Almost literally at the last moment there. I don't think it's for us to say, well, this is exactly why God did it. But it's amazing to see that. Certainly God is in control, and certainly God has plans for how he is allowing these events to expire. What's the word I'm looking for? Turn out. Go ahead, Holly.
It seems to me, too, as still a newer Christian, although it's been many, 5 years or whatever, that the fact that people would die is really lends the whole Christianity, I think, credibility, because all of these apostles could say, like, oh, I changed my mind, this was kind of a bad idea, and I kind of got on that train and now I'm getting off, and you know, that they would continue to follow Christ. Yeah. Even when, like, if you were killed, it's like, oh, Jeremy's killed because of his beliefs. I'd be like, okay, well, lay exactly. low, you know. It was good for a while. Yeah. Now, well, you
but,
know.
But along the line, actually, you'll see that Peter is not flippant about the fact. He doesn't exactly walk down the streets and say, "Hey, the Lord got me out. Here I am."
Yeah.
He goes. He gets out of town. He does yeah. go
exactly.
So I mean, there's some yeah, common but sense in all this.
Not
too.
To the point of like okay. changing their beliefs. Right, you know, of like, oh no, I think Buddhism is sounding good now.
Exactly. And that is, I think, powerful support for the resurrection. Because these weren't just like second or third generation people down the lines. These were the apostles that were with Jesus that were accused of hiding the body and of lying about all this. Well, if they did lie about this, why would almost every single one of them, I believe every single one of them was executed. John died of natural causes, but that was because he was exiled. Right. But if I'm not mistaken, either Luke or tradition records that every single one of them, the 12 in particular, were martyred for their beliefs. And so why would they do that if they knew it was a lie? Especially when they see what's happening to other people. What value were they gaining from that? It just doesn't match up with how humans act. But nonetheless, Herod, I mentioned earlier, he saw that he had Jewish blood in him. And this whole fact about when he saw that pleased the Jews is so reminiscent of Pontius Pilate. You know, he what can I do? This is what the crowd wants. Well, you can do whatever you want. You're the leader. You are the one that decides what to do. But Pilate act like, oh, well, I'm helpless. They want this, so I'm going to wash my hands of the matter. What a picture of human religion. What a picture of politics. Well, I can't. You want it, so I'm going to give it to you. So he proceeded to arrest Peter. I noted this earlier, but let me reiterate. They obviously, it seems, at least to me, obvious that they understood who the leaders were. And they're not just, well, you know, Stephen was kind of a instance of mob mentality where he just stirred up the crowd and they murdered him. Here is calculated. If they're going to choose somebody to try and put down the rebellion, well, let's choose the leaders. I mean, that's just basic military political strategy. If you want to put down a rebellion, you put down the leaders. You put down the ones who are going to, everyone's going to follow. I don't think anyone's going to get this illusion, but you go back in time and kill John Connor if you want to stop the rebellion. But nonetheless, it was during the days of unleavened bread. So the Feast of Unleavened Bread was about 7 days, 8 days. This was related to the Passover. So it was about 7 days of feast days that were holy days for the Jewish people there. And we saw this with the crucifixion of Jesus. Even though the Romans were in control, they basically allowed the Jewish people to kind of have their own customs.
Their gig.
They didn't just obliterate them. I mean, that was one of the ways that Rome was able to control. They would take over lands, but they would give the people a certain amount of autonomy. But ultimately, the authority was them. The Jews kind of had their autonomy there in Israel, but in order to execute anybody, they had to get permission from Rome. So there was a lot of cooperation going on there. And again, that's how the Romans were able to control so much land, is that they figured out, well, we don't just want to tear over everybody like Alexander the Great did, like the Greeks did. They just kind of bowled over everybody and, all right, now you're all Greek. Romans were much more calculated in how they interacted with these lands that they conquered here. So because it was during the feast days, Herod was not going to execute him during the feast days. He was going to wait throughout those feast days there. And I don't think this is coincidental that Herod arrested him during the feast days. There would have been a lot of Jews in Jerusalem at this time because it was the feast days. It was the Passover. And so for Herod to arrest Peter at this time, while so many Jews were in Israel, and then to execute him, well, that would just say, look, this small sect of people that are disrupting everything, look what I'm doing to put that down. So it seems very calculated on Herod's part that it was during this time that he would arrested Peter and planned to execute him. So he delivered him to four squads of soldiers. That word squad there is quaternion, which equals four soldiers. So 16 soldiers.
For one person,
that seems like a lot. I mean, this isn't, they're basically treating him like, here's another movie reference for you guys, Sean Connery's character in The Rock, you know, the only guy that escaped out of Alcatraz, and so we need to have all these people to keep him from escaping again. But at first I thought about that and said, wow, that seems like a lot. But then, and I think I missed this Sunday, in Acts 5 we have recorded where God miraculously let Peter, was it just Peter or was it Peter and James or Peter and John?
Peter and John.
So they escaped out of prison. So there's precedent, and as far as the Roman leaders are concerned, wow, this guy is amazing. He can get out of one of our Roman prisons here. And so we're not going to take any chance this time. We're going to have 16 soldiers that are there to guard him. And we'll get to this in a second, but the charge for when a Roman soldier was charged with guarding a prisoner, that was an extremely serious charge. They did not take that lightly at all. And so he delivered the four guards of soldiers to guard him. So now we have Peter in prison. 16 people. Well, what is the church going to do at this time? What recourse do they have? Well, they do exactly, and I forgot to write this down, but I love the way Wiest put this. Because the way Wiest translates this, he says, on the one hand, Peter's in prison, But then on the other hand, you have the Christians gathering together to pray, which is an amazing contrast, and I think something that can be so encouraging to us. So while Peter was kept in prison, what prayer for him was being made fervently by the church to God. So that word fervently means continually, intensely, earnestly. So you almost get the idea that around the clock, these people are gathered together to pray for him. And again, this isn't without precedent. Starting in Acts 4, the church gathered and prayed earnestly. In Acts 2, 42, after the miraculous event at Pentecost, what did the church do? They gathered and were praying continuously. So it seemed like the church understood their first recourse was to prayer. You know, what was it, Miles or Hallett said, it's come to this, we have to pray. You know, for us Christians, like, well, I got no other option, so now I'm just going to send out my Hail Mary. No, our first option ought to be to go to prayer and realize that our only option is to realize not necessarily asking God for what we want, but God, what do you want me to learn out of this? What are you going to do out of this? Help me to trust in you and see you working in this.
This is a dumb question that you don't have an answer for. But I can't imagine how people can pray that long. You know what I mean?
I know.
Like, what would we be doing sitting here, like, praying and praying and praying and praying and praying?
Well, Holly, think about this. You know, it's sort of depends upon how important the person is to you. If it's your child, it's a totally different thing.
And you can't think of anything else.
So, I mean, and if it's Peter, who's, you know, he's a person that led many people to the Lord.
Uh-huh.
Peter is a special man. I mean, it's sort of like
it
was tough to see Brother Hal go when he. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was a great, he was great because he followed the Lord, but. But his influence and your bond with that person just makes prayer just something that you do.
Or even, you know, like Vern, you know, I guess if he was taken away, it'd be like naturally on our minds. We're going to pray.
Or if he was ill or sick, and, you know. So, I mean, it kind of depends upon your relation with that person. I think that's why.
Exactly.
So it was something that came naturally from it, not something that they said, we're going to pray 24/7 and make sure you get here.
If you don't get here, you're...
Yeah, okay. All right, good. Thank you.
And something I've been struggling with for a long time now, it's understanding prayer in the context of grace. And just prayer in the context of Scripture. I mean, what is... not to sound flippant, but what is the point of prayer? You know, I heard a Catholic person once talk about, you know, why do they pray to saints? Well, the saints in heaven are closer. I mean, this is kind of putting it crudely, but they're closer to God. They have, you know, so if we can gather as many holy people together to pray to God, it's not that the saints can answer our prayer. It's that they have a little bit more influence, I guess, with God. And if we can just overwhelm God, he has no chance but to listen to our prayer. And I don't think that's it at all. Obviously, God's in control. Obviously, God can change events. From our perspective, I mean, it's interesting how many times throughout the Old Testament the Scripture records that God repented. And it's not that he... I think that's totally human perspective when we say this was the course of events and God altered the course of events from what they were going on. He stepped in. There was divine intervention. And certainly we can believe in divine intervention knowing full well that God knows exactly what's going to happen. But, we have parables of, you know, the lady who went to the judge and was just, you know, continually bugging him until the judge said, fine, I'll give you what you want. And I don't know what that parable means right now, but a lot of people think, well, if we just are earnest enough and pray long enough and get as many people to pray, God has no choice but to answer our prayer. I don't think that's it. And I don't have a full description of what prayer looks like under grace. But what we have here is an example of people that You know, I think they had faith. We'll look at it in a second. You know, did they actually believe their prayer would do anything? I think that's interesting to look at how they reacted when God answered their prayer. What does that say about what they were praying? Maybe they weren't necessarily praying for Peter. Maybe they weren't necessarily... We don't know what they were praying. So it may not be so much that they're praying that Peter would get out, but they realize they're in a tough situation and they just need to go to God. And maybe that's what it is. It's during these situations, we just need to run to God and rest in Him. I don't know if that's what they were doing, but certainly that's something we can do.
Well, it says they are praying for Him, but it doesn't say...
Oh, that's right. Prayer for Him was made.
But it doesn't say what they were praying. You know, many times we'll pray a person... he'd be healed from his sickness, but maybe a better prayer sometimes is to pray that they'll see, you know, they'll trust God through that situation. That's
right.
Actually, that way you're not saying, God, you have to heal this person. You're putting constraints on him. You say, well, I'm going to pray for this person. You have to heal him. You know, you're saying, God, I know you're sovereign, and we're going to pray that your will be done and that the person realize what's going on here and trust you. And so it's, and I agree, you know, prayer is a... I know Bonnie and I have many discussions about prayer. That's always...
Yeah.
He says, well, if God already knows it, why are we praying? And, you know, and you go through that loop a couple times, but then he says, pray without ceasing. You say, well, I guess he wants me to pray.
Yeah.
So it is a very, you know, interesting...
But that is a good point. They are praying for him. But what happens, again, their response, I think... It's not out of the realm of the text to say that maybe they weren't praying for his escape, but they were just praying that God is with him during this time, and that God is with them, and that they continue to look to him, even though, I mean, this is the guy at the time. Peter, if he's gone, what are they going to do? How many of you guys were alive in 1963? I mean, I can look back. Having not been alive, I can only read the historic documents. What a blow it was to America when Kennedy was assassinated. Because he was, whether or not you agreed with him, enough people agreed with him and saw him as this is the guy. He's gonna lead us out of these. You know, he's gonna lead us into the future. And when they talk about 1963 as a year. American innocence died. It's like, what a crushing blow, because if he's gone, then what else? And when you look at everything else that happened in the 60s and the 70s, it had a profound impact on American, I don't know what you would call it.
Outlook.
American outlook, just our optimism, and it was a devastating blow. I think even more so, this was the leader of the church. If he had died, where would they be? And so their immediate reaction, it seems, is to go to pray. And you know, you talk about prayer. We don't know exactly when Peter was... It just says during the days of unleavened bread. So it could have been as much as 7 days, 6 or 7 days, that these people were praying. And again, the text is praying constantly for him. So they might have been praying for as much as 7 days. But nonetheless, on the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward. Now, how many times do we see this? Where it seems like God waits for the last minute. And it would be easy for humans to say, well, how cruel is that? I mean, why does God have to wait till, as far as we can tell, Abraham is... that's the story. Abraham has the knife in the air about to slay Isaac, and God says, stop, Abraham. I mean, why does he... That just seems like he's teasing us. That seems like he's cruel. Or from you know, when you look at the importance of what God is doing, when you look at it from God's perspective, he is just showing us that we need to wait on him, that there is no last minute with God, that there is no, in a sense, there is no 11th hour with God, because he's going to accomplish his purpose, and we need to, and we're in a place where we can trust him that even when all hope seems lost, we can continue trust in God. And there are times where he, from our perspective, it works out. James, it didn't work out, right? Jesus, when he was crucified, I mean, how devastated were the the apostles when Jesus was crucified. They were totally devastated. Even though Jesus had time and time again told them what was going to happen, they were still devastated, and man, it didn't work out. No, from God's perspective, it always works out. But nonetheless, the very night when Herod's about to bring him forward, Peter was sleepy. Why wouldn't you sleep? You're chained up by two soldiers.
Yeah.
There's another 12 soldiers guarding you. On the night before, you are to be executed, and he's sleepy. I mean, I can't remember if it was Constable who said, you know, there was a passage, and I should have written it down. I didn't. Where Jesus indicated that Peter would have a long life. Maybe he's thinking of that, and yeah, this is going to work out. God's getting me out of prison before. Or maybe he's just at peace with whatever God has for him. It's amazing. Maybe this is exactly what the people are praying for. Give Peter peace. He has that peace, and the night before his execution, he's sleeping. Between two soldiers bound with chains, the guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. And the angel of the Lord suddenly appeared, and a light shone in the cell. So, this is fascinating. A light shone. None of the guards wake up. And he had to struck Peter on the side. Say, hey, Peter, get up. Wake up quickly.
And that's
it. His chains fell off. I mean, this whole event is miraculous. And the way Luke records this is, I mean, Luke isn't one for hyperbole. Luke isn't one for making up stuff. He's very detailed. And the light shown in there struck Peter on the side, woke him up, said, get up quickly, and his chains fell off.
What's really ironic is that these were not just temple guard soldiers. These were Roman soldiers using the Roman terminology for squad and all that.
Exactly.
And I can imagine them showing these busted up chains to Pilate and saying, we had no control over the situation. Could you do this?
Exactly. Exactly. And so, and this is fascinating. I mean, Peter's woken up apparently from a sound sleep. He has not any clue what's going on. The angel here has to guide him through every single step. So, gird yourself, put on your sandals. I can imagine, Peter starts walking out, you got to gird yourself, put your sandals on. Wrap your cloak around. Come on, Peter. It's like, we were getting ready to go to see fireworks on Friday night, and so we're getting ready to go. Colette's in the car, doesn't have her shoes on, she's just sitting in the car waiting to go. Colette, where are your shoes? Oh, are you dressed all the way? No. We have to tell them, get your shoes on, comb your hair, brush your, every little thing we have to tell them. And Peter followed without questioning. They pass the first and second guard. They go to the gates open for them, which, nowadays we don't think too much about that.
Right.
Gates, doors opening on their own. Until they don't, then we do think about that. But Peter's just okay.
And also
he's still kind of groggy. He thinks he's having a vision.
Right. He doesn't realize it's reality.
And so, which is fascinating. Maybe that's why he's so complacent. Hey, I've had these visions before. Right. Why would I argue with him? Why would I question what the angels tell me to do? And so he gets outside. And then he comes to himself. I love that passage. Peter came to himself. Oh, yeah, now I'm out in the free. He says, now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me. Which is really interesting. And I asked this question earlier, and we don't have an answer for it. Why was James killed and Peter spared? We don't have an answer. That's what happened. It's really the answer we have. Why was Paul in prison for such a longer time? That was, a different event, I guess. But still, God could have... Paul's in prison several times, but the last time he's in prison for 2 years. It's just interesting to look at this and realize that things don't have to make sense from a human perspective. But whether from a human perspective they seem good or bad, we can trust that God is in control here. So, and when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. So Peter went to the house of Mary, the mother of John. This is the first mention I believe it's the first mission of John Mark. He's going to show up quite a bit later. We'll see him again at the last of the chapter, and he's going to become one of the main missionaries, I guess you could say, one of the main evangelists. I think it's interesting, why were the people gathered here? We don't have any context. We just have that this is where they were gathered. And right away, Peter knew this is where to go. Maybe the angel told him, I don't know. The scripture doesn't recall. But does anyone want to offer some baseless speculation? Why do you think they were gathered here? And why did Peter think to go there first?
I'm suspecting that John Mark was probably the biggest coward of them all, but that didn't make the rest of the apostles any less cowards. So they just decided on mutual consent, hey, we're all in the same boat here, and we all had to ditch to get away from the potential arrest ourselves. And so that might have been kind of by mutual agreement.
Maybe. I like to think that maybe he had risen to prominence. I don't know. That he's somewhat of a deacon, I guess you could call it at this point. Not necessarily one of the original apostles, but he seems to be of some of the importance. Because at the end of the chapter, Paul and Barnabas decide to take him with them on their missionary journey. So he was somebody that they trusted. Maybe he was the one gathering people. Say, hey, we need to get together and pray for him. Maybe they were hiding. I don't know.
Maybe Mary had a big house.
Yeah, maybe he just had the biggest house. But I do find it interesting that this is where the people were gathered, and this is where Peter thought to go right away. So he goes to the house, knocks on the door. The servant girl, Rhoda, came to answer, recognizes the voice of Peter, and immediately runs inside and leaves him out there. So this is in April, as far as we know, in the middle of the night. So it might have been a little cool out there. And she just leaves him, ran in and asks that Peter is standing in the front gate. And the reaction of the people is so great. You're out of your mind. So my paraphrase, the way I've always thought of this is, you're crazy, Rhoda. How can Peter be out of prison if we're praying for him in prison? Doesn't make sense. So, and this exchange is great. They say, you're out of your mind. Literally, you're raving mad. You're nuts. You're crazy. And notice this passage. She kept on insisting that it was so, and they kept on saying, "It's his angel. It's maybe he died, and it's his guardian angel, or maybe he sent an angel to come to us." I mean, they explain it away. It's odd, I think, at least for us, that they explain it using supernatural explanation, but still they explain it away. And you imagine. So what's happening is, Rhoda is continuing to insist. Peter's at the front gate. The other people are continuing to insist. You're crazy. You don't know what you're talking about. Peter is outside continuing to knock on the door, waiting for someone to let in. Which is one of the reasons why I think it's so helpful we don't have church meetings, business meetings. Because basically, that describes your average church meeting. This group's continuing to do this. This group's continuing to do this. This other group's continuing to do this. None of them are working together, and you just end up with a lot of people angry for no reason whatsoever. And so, and this goes back to the prayer. Did they not? This is assuming they were asking God to get Peter out. Maybe they weren't. But they're praying, and God does a miraculous event, and it's like, well, no, this is not at all what they were expecting. Maybe they were praying for something else, but when some miraculous event happens, they're completely unprepared for it. I don't think this says anything about their lack of faith. I think it was Constable, Merriman that says, these unbelieving believers.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think they're unbelieving. I just think that this is such an extraordinary event that they weren't at all prepared for it. I don't think you can fault them at all. I think what this says to us is we always have to expect the unexpected, right? If that's possible. Is it possible to expect the unexpected? Talk about the known unknown or the unknown known or the unknown unknown. Anyway. But I think what this says to us is that there are plenty of times, I won't say often, but there are plenty of times where the way God works things out are going to be completely outside of anything we could ever imagine, completely expect. I'm going to use this verse completely incorrectly out of context, but there's a passage in Corinthians that says, God is able to do exceedingly abundantly all that you ask or think. There's another passage that says, I have not seen nor ear hath heard what is prepared for the heart of man. Of course, people use that for heaven, but that's talking about here and now. And to use those, to contort those and apply those here, we often don't have any idea how God's going to do work things according to His plan. And a lot of them just going to take us off guard. And again, we can't fault the people there. Something happened. Well, why did that happen? And then we get down the road and think, oh yeah, that worked out. God was able to use that in a tremendous way in my life. So expect the unexpected. So from Peter continued knocking. And when they opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. And he motioned with them to be silent. So I imagine they're yelling. I don't know what their reaction would be. But apparently their reaction was, the implication is their reaction was pretty loud.
Right.
He motioned them to be silent. He described to them how the Lord had led them out of prison. Luke is careful to record that, either he's careful to record that this is what God's doing, or he's careful to record that Peter, you know, when we talked about the event with Cornelius, Peter was careful to say, God did this, God did this. Not just me. I didn't just go into this house where there were Gentiles and start preaching to them. God worked this out miraculously. And he said, report these things to James and the brethren. So this James is the half-brother of Jesus. He's the one that wrote the epistle. So some time for some more speculation here. He said, report these things to the brethren. Why do you think he said it? Was it just to let them know that, okay, he's okay? Was it to let them know that, okay, I've got out, so maybe Herod's going to be pretty angry, and we need to be aware that things may get more dangerous for us? Tom?
Well, there's one key factor that's in there. It's the 5,000 who were saved, and probably many since. So it's not them all by themselves, just the apostles. Let's get this generally out to all the brethren.
Right.
Well, but you know, it kind of fits in the thing that the Jews were very much attesting miracles as kind of their badge that God is working, and this was definitely an attesting miracle. So it kind of fits well that here's an attesting miracle. This validates it. The true God is working in this new sect called the Christians, and this is the true God working. We have a miracle to prove that.
Exactly. So,
well, I was just thinking, too, he's just writing this now. They didn't have that before when it happened. They didn't have it. They couldn't turn to their Bible and read about it. So.
Exactly.
So that's why it was told then.
And then we don't know what happens. Did Peter go into hiding?
Right.
I don't know, but it's interesting. What happens next? So when the day came, there was no small disturbance. You know, Luke is just so down low. There's no small... Yeah, I would say there's no small disturbance. And the importance, I alluded to this earlier, under the Roman law, these Roman guards, if their prisoner escaped, they would have been given the same death sentence of the person who escaped. Peter was given a life sentence. So the lives of the guards were at stake here. So there is certainly no small disturbance. And you see this again in Acts 16:27, when Paul this time, who God let him out of prison, and when the prison guard came and saw that he was gone, he was ready to take his own life. Because if he didn't, he would have been executed as well. So of course there was no small disturbance as to what had become of Peter. As Tom said, you know, broken... How did this guy break the chains, escape from 16 Roman centurions?
And the gate open.
You know, and the gate open. This is no small feat whatsoever. And when Herod had searched for him and not found him, that's what's fascinating. Did God hide Peter? Did Peter go into hiding? Why was it that Herod wasn't able to search for him? I mean, as we talked about earlier, this was politically to Herod's great advantage to make a big statement like this. So it's not like he, you know, it's not like, I don't know what my kids keep coming up today. It's not like my kids when I ask them to go look for something. You know, I can't find my shoes. Well, go look in your room. I can't find them. Actually, look. You have to move stuff. You know, it doesn't help that you have clothes piled 2 feet high on the floor. There's every indication that Herod would have diligently search for him. So why wasn't he able? Is this another miracle? Maybe God was able to take him out, put him in hiding. Maybe the people worked together and they were able to hide him. We don't know, but we know that Herod had not found him. He examined the guards in order that they'd be led away to execution. And then he just gives up. You know, fine, that's done. I'm going to leave and go on to other business here. And this next passage is interesting because, again, this is kind of a parenthetical passage. But Luke, under the inspiration of God, clearly has a reason to put this in here. So Herod tries to find them, can't find them. He puts the Roman guards to death. And then he leaves. He goes down to Caesarea. Now, he was very angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon. Again, we don't have any context here. We just know he's angry with this small, I guess you could call it a county, basically. And we'll see later, because their country was fed by the king's country. So basically, they're on welfare of some sort. This is the beginning of this, or starting to get to this famine. We don't know how intense the famine is at this time. But nonetheless, the small people were dependent on the governor there, and he was angry with them. Maybe it's just arbitrary, but nonetheless, he's angry with them. So they came to him asking for peace. They have won over Blastus, the king's chamberlain. I love all these little political details that you have in here. They want to make peace with Herod, so they make right with his chamberlain, his chief of staff. So you know, if they have his ear, then they have a better chance of making things right with Herod. And on the appointed day, so apparently Herod goes to make some type of a speech to these people there of Tyre and Sidon. And we get a lot of this from Josephus as well. I'll go back to that. But the historian Josephus records a lot of that. So on the appointed day, Herod began delivering an address to them. Having put on his royal apparel, Josephus records that he had a silver robe that would have glittered in the sunlight. So picture this. I mean, in the Roman Empire, they already had an exalted view of the leadership. And he stands before the people in these royal garments, up on this rostrum, as Luke says, and gives a speech. We don't have any idea what he says, which I think it's... Constable says, interesting, we don't have a clue what he said, but we know what we have the words of the word of God that persists to this day. We don't know what he said, but apparently it had a huge impact on the people, because the people kept crying out, the voice of a God and not a man. And I didn't dig into this, but I'm assuming, by the way it's translated here, kept crying out. It wasn't just, yeah, this is the voice of God. It's like they're shouting it over and over. And from what we get here, Herod's response is, yeah, that's right. You know, he doesn't do anything to stop. In fact, he almost glories in it. Because what happens is, immediately the angel of the Lord struck him.
Apparently it had an impact on God.
Yeah, it had an impact on God. So this kind of reminds us of Ananias and Sapphira. They lied before God. Immediately they're struck down. Herod didn't die right away, but immediately he was struck with the sickness. Back here at the end, it says, Luke records, and he was eaten by worms and died. I'm not exactly sure what it was. Maybe it was appendicitis. Josephus records that he had a stomach ache and had to be carried out, and then he died 5 days later on August 6, 44. That's where we get that date. So, and I mean, I can imagine the people are crying out, this is the voice of God, and Herod's like, yeah, you know, it kind of is, and all of a sudden he gets, you know, some stomach ache. Intense enough that he had to be carried out. And he dies 5 days later. So I ask these questions, and these may not be appropriate questions at all. Luke, under the inspiration of God, records because he did not give the glory of God. So what does this say about God's kingship, God's ruler over the earth? So, I mean, as much as we talk about the fact that we are in Christ and in the particular relationship that we in the church have with Christ, it is the fact that God still has ultimate authority over the earth. It is the fact that He is going to establish His kingdom one day on the earth. So, what does this say about God's kingdom? Does this say anything about God's kingdom and His relationship with it? Does this say anything about God's expectation for political leaders and as far as their understanding that any authority they have is granted to them by God? That's what Romans 13 talks about.
It seems to hark back to when David mentioned, the King David, that God raises up and puts kings down. It's nothing new. He's done it around my time, too.
Well, I think it's... some people might look at this and say, you know, look to our leaders. If you deny God, God's going to strike you down. Well, we can't say that. We can say that it has happened before. It happened in Acts. But to say that this is going to happen now, I think is a stretch. But we still need to understand God's kingship over the earth. God is the ultimate authority over the earth. I think we need to understand... all human authority is placed there by God. But this is an extraordinary event. You know, several extraordinary events that I think we need to think a lot about. Luke is recording them, so it had an impression on him, and the Spirit led him to put these in here. But the ultimate results, as always it seems, is the word of the Lord continue to grow and be multiplied. I mean, isn't that the normal pattern? Persecution leads to growth through God's church. Often there's divine intervention. But we've seen that throughout history. It seems like the more people try to persecute the church, the more the church grows. The stronger the church grows. And so, Paul and Barnabas, or Saul and Barnabas, returned from Jerusalem and they had fulfilled their mission. Their mission was bringing food and other supplies to the church there, as we just talked about in chapter 11. And so they take along with them John Mark. And I mentioned this, John Mark had apparently become prominent in the church there. He was the cousin of Barnabas. We have that recorded in Colossians 4:10. And I wanted to look real quickly. The next chapter, we kind of go on to another little segment, story here. But it's like, it is as though Luke is just, you know, put him in here kind of as a teaser. We're going to see this guy, he establishes, you know, his connection, and that he's now connected with Paul and Barnabas here. But we're going to come back to him later. So, fascinating passage. I don't think this tells us a whole lot about how we interact with authority, how authority is supposed to interact. I don't think this tells us specifically how we should pray and the expectations we should have when we pray, other than the fact that we can always go to God, we can rest in Him through these dire situations. And often, God is always working, and often God is going to work in ways that we completely don't expect at all. Which is really interesting. And the dryness, I think, with how Luke tells this story, especially with Peter going to the house, I think makes it all the more humorous. Any final comments or questions? Okay, Tom, do you mind closing us in a word of prayer?
Thank you, Heavenly Father, for this Spirit-led teaching. Thank you for your servant. I commend all who gave the presentation. And Lord, bless these lessons and the word, your word, precious word, into our heart, to where we can see from even current events and from our personal lives through lesser authorities and experience with them that you are not powerless in areas where we feel powerless, and to you be the glory. Amen.